Welcome to Better Words, a podcast for readers who want to know the stories behind the pages.
We're your hosts, Caitlin and Michelle, two book nerds who bring you in-depth conversations about writing and publishing from those on the inside.
Basically, we're just here to talk about books.
We're so glad you're joining us.
Hello, happy 2025. Even though it's the end of January.
Oh my God, happy 2025. I feel like since maybe the middle of November has just been a blur.
Crazy, I know.
So much. So,
yeah,
we're very excited to, you know, be back on mic and, like, give another recommendation and say happy 2025.
I know.
We had the grandest of intentions for this episode to be released before Christmas. Or
I dropped the ball in
Christmas.
A big way.
Oh, it was, it's been so busy.
I just didn't edit it. Oh. I just did not edit it.
And it was like, it just kind of, I think we both got to that point that's a bit like, it's Christmas now, like holiday mode, like, oh my God, it's just not happening. And
well, I was not in holiday mode.
No, but like yes, in holiday mode. It was the festive season. Yeah. Just because you were technically like
it was
working.
The festive season. Yeah. Busier than ever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it was so busy. Yeah. I know. And yeah. I just stopped. So my busy. Brain stopped working.
Yeah.
So that's where we've been at. And so in our attempt, we're so organized, everyone. We
so
did
organized.
Record an intro for this already, and it's so out of date now that we thought we would just hop back on and maybe
quickly
tell you about what we read over Christmas instead, ahead of our proper 2024 full year wrap up, where we talk about all of our favorite things for the year, one of our favorite things to do. Love going over all of that.
I know, it's so much fun. That's where we're at. And the interview that we are sharing today as well, really excited to share, because since we recorded this as well, the book has been made a Waterstones Book of the Month for January. So I have also had the pleasure of talking about this and recommending it endlessly to like every single customer. And that's been an absolute joy. It's always so much fun to have a book to sell for Book of the Month that I'm not going to say genuinely really love, because like I do try to read the books and obviously, I can't read five of them every month, but I try to pick one book to read and then, you know, recommend it to who I think would like it. But
it is nice to be
Suspicious Things,
a bit more connected.
It was one of my
favorite
books.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it was one of my favorite books last year. And so there's that to say to people that like, I loved this book last year. But I don't know, it always feels a bit different to then say, oh yeah, like I really enjoyed this, I think this is going to be a really great read, versus like just something I really, really, really love. So yeah, we've had so much fun. Last Saturday, my colleague Beth and I worked, and it was just the two of us, and it was super, super, super busy, and it's always hard when there's only two of you. We sold 10 copies of List of Suspicious Things, so smashed it.
Wow.
So yeah, we are having so much fun recommending it. It's great. Anyway,
excellent.
That's a side note. So if you're in the UK, you've probably seen this book around a lot now. It's in paperback. Highly recommend you get it.
Yes, and hopefully you'll be even more convinced after hearing our chat. But
yeah.
Before we get there, Michelle, are you recommending a book that you read kind of over that festive season, or is it your first read of 2025? What are we...
Look, I can give you two recommendations.
How lucky are we?
So what I did read during the absolute insanity of Christmas was a book called Rewitched by Lucy Jane Wood, which is so adorable, so brilliant, loved it, a late favorite of the year. It was excellent. It is essentially like if you grew up watching Sabrina the Teenage Witch, like the old school one with the dodgy talking cat and everything, like it is those vibes, but she's 30. Like it's so good. It's such a like millennial
sold.
Dream.
Love Sabrina.
I know. Like, so I actually borrowed this from my friend Liz, but then I went out and bought my own copy because I just think I'm going to return to it. When she described it to me, I was like, oh, it sounds like Charmed when they're like turning 30 and that's when they like their powers all like activate, for lack of a better word. Like the first episode of Charmed, I'm pretty sure, is like they're all normal.
Was everyone in
Charmed?
And they're
sort of all turning 30.
Were they all 30 in Charmed? I wasn't super into Charmed, I mean, but I remember everyone watching it when we were younger, and I think I thought that they were teenagers.
No, well, no, they're definitely not teenagers. They're not all 30 because they're sisters and they're not triplets. So
yeah, right.
They're not all 30, but like there's a point where I think it's after their mum died or something.
Something activates their powers. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And they're all just like living a normal life until then.
That's so funny.
So I immediately said, oh, it sounds like Charmed. And she was like, yeah, I think that's the vibe. So it's like a bit like Bewitched meets Charmed meets Sabrina the Teenage Witch. It's very cozy and cute. I know, perfect.
So good. I mean, I obviously just said I haven't seen Charmed, but I love the other two.
Yeah. I think Charmed, like, I went through a big phase of loving it. I think because, and this is the reason why I think that maybe you could get on board with it. I feel like with Charmed, there was lots of, like, emotional sister drama and, like, relationship drama that it didn't ever just feel like us, because, you know, we're not like fantasy girlies.
Yeah.
So it didn't ever feel like that. I mean, yes, they were fighting demons every single episode, but then like Piper's trying to run her little club and, you know, Prue's trying to figure out who she's in love with and things like that. Like and then like towards later season, like Phoebe's an advice columnist and it's just, you know, there's all this other stuff that's happening. And then when Piper has kids.
That actually sounds so up my alley. I kind of can't believe I've never watched it.
Maybe we should, because I would be happy to like rewatch it. Maybe it's something we should like watch together.
Yeah, maybe we should.
Because I would love to hear your thoughts as someone coming in for the first time. But yeah, then like when Piper has kids, there's that whole drama. And then there's like her relationship with her husband. And, you know, it's really, really good. I was totally hooked as a teenager. I really enjoyed it. And now I'm like, oh, it's because there were other things as well.
Yeah.
So that's what I will say about Rewitched, because I've just read another book that is like pure romance that I was like a bit bored by because it didn't have enough like plot. So I will say that Rewitched has this great plot to it. The other cute thing about this, so Bella is a bookseller. So
oh,
there's
fun.
That cute element as well. I know. But basically, so she has always had like witch powers ever since I think she was like 15 when she like gets her powers. So she's had them for a while. She's turning 30. She works at this bookshop. She loves the shop, but her boss is like her son's taken over and he's absolute horrible, you know, classic man who we hate. He's ruining everything. He wants to like make it this profitable business. And she's like, no, but the vibe, like you're ruining the magic of the lovely bookshop. But she's too scared to buy the bookshop from her boss who had offered it to her because she's like, you're perfect for this. And she's like, no, I'm too scared. She's turning 30 and she gets like this summons. Basically, she has to prove that she has used her magical powers in the best way possible. Otherwise, they will be taken from her. Like, has she utilized her powers in the last 15 years? And, you know, then she has to decide, does she want to keep her powers or not? And thus begins a quest of self-discovery and found friendship and, like, found family. And also maybe someone's trying to stop her making that decision. Ooh, why? So there's all these other little elements in there. There is a bit of romance, but it's really much a very... That is a subplot to Bella's self-discovery and decision of what she wants to do in her life. And I think that that, like the whole, like, yeah, she's turning 30 thing. I remember Liz describing it to me. It's like she has to discover her magic stuff, but also like her spark for life, I guess, is how I would say it.
That sounds great.
Really recommend it. But also it was like the perfect cozy read that I needed after very, very long days. I could not concentrate on books for weeks. Like, and then if you'll allow me to do my second one, I'll just do it and then you can do yours. So one of my most anticipated reads, I was lucky enough to get a proof copy from the publisher at the end of last year, and I sort of saved it for post-Christmas. But I sort of knew I would love it, so I'm really glad that I did. And I bought a copy for myself after anyway, because I have most of her other books anyway. And that is So Thrilled For You by Holly Bourne. So we've both read a handful of Holly's young adult books.
Yeah.
They're great. Highly recommend her for like teen girls and stuff. But I think both of us, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but I feel like because of the age we are, her adult books just hit different.
Yeah.
They're so good.
Like, yeah. What her adult books are is just, yeah. So it's, yeah, they she's are, just incredible.
Like, piercing.
Mm.
Yeah. They are, she captures like womanhood and female life, like, so good. So that is no different in So Thrilled For You. In fact, I think it's the best book yet that she has done. Basically centers around four women. I guess the difference here from her other books, if you've read them before, they're more contemporary. This has like an extra added mystery element. I would say it's like a little bit like Big Little Lies style, where we sort of know something happened. So we know there was a fire at a baby shower. But then as we're reading the book, we are piecing together that day and trying to work out how that happened.
Okay. Yeah, right.
So personally, and I know I'm going to guess this would be the same for you, I could read her book about the relationships between the four women. Like, I would eat that up anyway, right?
Yeah.
But the fact that there's this extra mystery element just makes it even more of a page turner, like, because you're like, well, I really want to know now who set the fire. Why the relationships between these women are so interesting as well is because she's written four women who I think there will be something that almost every woman will relate to some part of this. So
yeah,
the four women, there is Steffi, who is child free by choice, really happily so, and she's actually starting her own publishing. She's starting her own agency. She's got a big publishing deal that she's trying to manage, like $1 million, massive, like preemptive Netflix offers and stuff. So she's trying to manage that. Wow. The day of the baby shower, and obviously really excited that her business is launched so well. We've got Lauren, who's got a 9-month-old baby and is in absolute hell. And like, honest to God, reading Lauren's chapters made me like really scared about the possibility of having a baby, because I was like, this sounds terrible. She is really struggling.
Yeah.
Yeah, literally. But also like struggling more than, I mean, obviously all motherhood is like all newborn stage and stuff. That is going to be a struggle. But I think what we see here is these like postnatal depression.
Yeah. She's having a really
and
rough go.
Like something even more severe. And then there's Charlotte, who is desperately trying to have a baby, has wanted one for so long, is doing IVF, but is also organizing the baby shower for their friend Nikki, who is like super super pregnant.
Yeah,
so that is how they all come together. They've been friends since university, but I think she just deconstructs the elements of those friendships so much, and the way that the little like cracks within that and how they are starting to widen, I guess. So obviously, like I said, like I would read about those four women regardless, even if there was like literally no plot. I'm here for those relationships.
Even if theoretically nothing happened at the baby shower, there's still lots of complicated literally feelings and everything.
I know. It's so good, especially because extra stuff is like revealed about basically each woman. They're all keeping secrets from each other and from themselves sometimes as well. So that all unfolds. We get a chapter from each of their perspectives. So you really do feel, and it does feel like really different voices each time as well. So if you like contemporary fiction, if you know, like the vibe of Big Little Lies and stuff like that, but you just love like anything that delves into like complicated female characters, I she just does it so well. I just, it feels so real, and it feels like angry and raw in a really good way.
Yeah.
It's superb, and quite rightly, I think, on the bestseller list already. I'm not sure, but I immediately went into work, and the second it came out, wrote a rec card for it. So yeah, I absolutely love it. So that's So Thrilled for You by Holly Bourne. So that's my two recommendations.
Oh, awesome. I'm like so desperate to read both of those now.
As you should be. I think you'll really enjoy both of those books.
Yeah. So good. My recommendation today is also my Christmas read, and funnily enough, also like cozy, light fantasy kind of vibe. So it's one that I got from work. We published it at work by HarperCollins, but I didn't work on the campaign, so I hadn't had a chance to read it yet. Thoroughly Disenchanted by Alexandra Almond. So it is like a cozy fantasy mystery, and what it is that 100 years ago, Genevieve and Oliver, with a couple of their friends, went away for the weekend in regional Victoria, and for some reason those two got stuck there, and they've been trapped in the manor for 100 years. And one,
okay, already I'm like, I don't usually read fantasy. I'm kind of into a time slip.
Yeah.
I like this.
Yeah. So the world like goes on around them. They're stuck there. They are not aging. They can't like leave the border of the property. The house and the property seem like a little bit magical. Like they started growing things, and like they go into the library.
Can other people, oh my God, I've got so many questions about this world now. Can other people see? They're not like ghosts. I'm just imagining ghosts, essentially.
Yeah, so
like
they're
the
not.
TV
so
show
they're not.
Ghosts,
yeah, I know.
Where they can't like leave the boundary.
Yeah,
the
so they're not. Oh so God. They're not ghosts. They're living there. But yeah, so the house is a bit magical. So like they talk about different things. Like they started growing things, and they have a couple of animals, and they like, you know, you go into the library, and suddenly this book on like how to build a barn is there, and you're like, yes, we need to build a barn. And so like the house is like helping them and like leading them, and it's like, is it haunted, is it magic, like what's going on? And one of their friends who was on the weekend away with them can come and go, and so he had left and like two of the friends, like they'd like left, and Genevieve and Oliver were there and realized that they couldn't leave. And it's Finn, I think, he was away, and he had been planning to move overseas, and it became this thing that he realized he wasn't aging, and something had happened on this weekend away, and so he comes back so he can come and go. So he goes to visit them, and he like brings them things that they can't get from the outside world. And it's so funny because it's been 100 years, right? So there's this like funny reference in the book about like how Finn is loaded because he bought a house in Melbourne in like 1940, and
of
you know,
course.
So like he's
oh
got
God.
Like this real estate empire. Anyway, it's so funny. But the other thing with the house is that like in this kind of regional area in Victoria, like a couple of hours from Melbourne, about every 5 years there's a big storm and they get like an unexpected visitor. And so the book kind of starts, and we get some of all of that as like background kind of thing as going. But when the book starts, it's a storm night, and they're like, "This is strange. We aren't like it seems too soon for another like storm visitor, for like someone to visit." And so there's all this hijinks of like when people have come, of like they've hooked up with people that have come overnight, and like some people are scared. So they were a couple, they're not anymore. 100 years is a long time.
100 years.
Yeah. So yeah, it's so funny. So then there, it's like the book starts and it's a storm night, and a local Ella arrives, and it turns out that her ancestors have been so like frequent visitors, like so many people in her family have stumbled upon Genevieve and Oliver that it's become like a family legend. And
that she goes to try and look
yeah
for
so she
something.
Went to try and find them, and she found them.
That's cool.
And so then Finn, who's the one who can come and go, like, he comes as well. And so then the most of the book is the four of them. There's something about Ella that they, like, open up and, like, tell her what's, like, really going on. And then they all kind of, for the first time ever, start to be like, why did this happen to us? Is this house magic? Is it haunted? Should, you know, like, should we try and figure it out? Should we try and crack this puzzle? Like, is it an escape room? Like, and they kind of actually start to move on with their lives for the first time in like 100 years. And it's so fun. And I actually kind of wish, it's one of these ones, right, that I was on holidays over Christmas and New Year with my family. So I was like hanging out with my family just kind of all day, every day. And I wish that I had the opportunity to read this book quicker, because they are only together for a few days, like trying to figure all this out. In the manor, you know, like there's 100 years of backstories, we learn different pieces and everything, but I wish that I could have just like really sunk in it was like,
yeah,
it just would have been so perfect if it was like raining and I had a cup of tea and I was just sitting on the couch like, are they gonna, like, how do they solve the puzzle? And it's so fun. Yeah. And so, and like the four characters are so fun because, you know, there's like these old friends and this new friend, and they're all, you know, there's friendship and love and other complicated things and people hooking up, and yeah, it's so much fun. Yeah, so that's Thoroughly Disenchanted. It was, I thought it was heaps of fun.
That sounds really good, although sounds like I won't be able to get a copy because it's Australian.
Yes.
So fingers crossed for an international release, or maybe I finally need to, after like a year and a half, actually buy some books that I know, want from
we need
Australia.
To do this box, like,
we need to sort this out,
this shipping plan that we've had forever.
We would have
worked up quite a good pile for you now.
I know, oh my god. Anyway, that sounds really good. But I also, this is I think one of the reasons why I bought myself a copy of Rewitched, because I could only read it like in chunks after work, and I don't even think I wasn't taking it to work to read on my lunch breaks. I feel like I was reading something random or just like having a mini breakdown in the staff room and not like, I wasn't, whatever it was, I don't remember. So it kind of been like that important.
Mm.
So yeah, I think that's one of the reasons I bought myself coffee, because I thought, gosh, when it gets to, it's very much like cozy autumn vibes here.
Yeah.
So I think when it gets to that time of year again, I will very happily, you know, really? Light a candle, yeah, get my tea on a day off and just get into it, because I did feel like, I remember reading a lot of it in the morning before I went to work, like Jack would bring me a cup of tea, but still that's like maybe 15 minutes of reading time. Mm. And I just wanted to read more, I wanted to be in that,
yeah,
world
just
more.
Really
so,
sink in.
Yeah, yeah. But Thoroughly Disenchanted sounds lovely.
Yeah, it is lovely.
See, I can do that when there's like, I didn't even think of that as fantasy. I think of like a time slip novel, but I guess the house is a bit magical.
Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? It's like very light. I can do that. I can,
yeah,
do that.
No, we, this is the kind of, you know, we sort of joke that we're not big fans of fantasy, but we do like a, yeah, lot of, you know, like a time slip or like some time travel or like a magical house or like, yeah, you just work in a, yeah, bookshop, but you happen to be a witch. Like, we,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, all of that fun
that
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with that, we shall keep talking because we're going to record our 2024 wrap-up episode.
Yeah, so that'll be in your ears very, very soon. But, you know, the listening doesn't stop here because we have our wonderful interview.
Yeah, enjoy our chat with Jenny. Our guest today was raised in West Yorkshire, and her debut novel, The List of Suspicious Things, was inspired by her childhood there in the 1970s. She's from a mill-working family, but as the first generation born after the mills closed, she went to university and built a career in the corporate world. But in 2020, she left and began to write. and she is now a writer and part-time Waterstones bookseller and lives in the Somerset countryside. We are so excited to welcome Jenny Godfrey to the podcast. Welcome.
Hello, I'm really thrilled to be here. Thank you very much for asking me.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so excited about this because this has definitely been one of my top reads of the year. And and it's been a while since the hardback came out, but it felt right to chat to you about it. I said to Caitlin, I just think it's such an amazing book. But it's also, as we sort of record and release this after Christmas in the new year, the paperback will be coming out in the UK.
Yes.
So people will be seeing it around again, and that will be absolutely wonderful. So it seems like the right time to chat to you and just sort of talk about, yeah, this book that... Yeah, I absolutely loved. My colleagues at work have loved. So can you start by telling us a little bit about The List of Suspicious Things?
I absolutely can, if my head doesn't expand too far to speak. thank you for saying such nice things about it. So The List of Suspicious Things, as you said, is set in 1970s West Yorkshire. And it's the story of 12-year-old Miv. And Miv's home life is quite difficult. Money is tight. Her mum is really poorly in a way she can't quite understand. Margaret Thatcher has just become Prime Minister. And there's an undercurrent of fear in Yorkshire caused by the murders that have been taking place since 1975. And because of all these things, Miv's dad, Austin, decides that he's going to move the family down south, which for northern people is a terrible thing. It's like a fate worse than death. And Miv decides that she is going to make Yorkshire safe again and a place where her family might want to continue living. And to do so, she's going to find the murderer. And so she recruits her best friend, Sharon, and together they create this list of suspicious things, and they investigate them one by one. But in doing so, they inevitably find out all the secrets of their small town.
Yeah, I think not even the whole north-south thing. I mean, it is, but it's that idea of like when you're 12 and you hear that maybe
leaving
your parents
home.
Thinking about moving, like everything, oh my God, everything changes. And actually that makes me think, like, Caitlin, you weren't that old, were you? But your family moved states in Australia and like did a big move. And like, were you excited for that? Like, that's the thing. It's like when you're a kid and you're like, can't even imagine living anywhere else. It just seems so scary. And so, yeah, Miv wants to do everything to stop that. But yeah, Caitlin, your family did a big move.
We did. We moved from Adelaide to Central Queensland when I was 10. And I think in some ways I was young enough to not think about it that much. Like, yeah. I think even 12 makes a big difference to that. And like, there was someone I was speaking to recently and she was considering like a big move for her family, and her kids are about the same age as me and my siblings all were when we moved. And I was like, they will be fine. They will not. I was like, I know you're worried about, like, they have friends now, obviously, but I was like, they're young enough that this is not a big deal. I was like, high school and that kind of thing, it gets harder to move your family. And I can understand, like, even 12, I think, is old enough to, like, really feel like you're starting to, like, find your place in the world a bit. And it's that is old enough to know everything is going to be different.
And I didn't care. Miv's also clinging on, like you said, her mum is really ill. And so part of, I think, what you explore in this
she just
is...
She wants to fix it, everything.
Yeah, she just wants it to go back to the way it was. And yes. moving away would completely take any chance of that returning again. I really love that you sort of told it through Miv's eyes as well, because I think we as adults reading it obviously bring all this knowledge to it. But why did you think, right, I'm gonna tell it from this more childlike perspective?
Do you know what? I actually, even as you're saying that, I'm thinking, I have no idea why I decided to do it like that, because everyone said to me, don't do it. Like, people said to me, like, people involved in publishing or writers, everyone said to me, don't do it from a child's perspective, not for your first novel, because it's really difficult to get it right. I think for me, actually, there is a reason. And one of the biggest reason is, I think the story of the Yorkshire Ripper has been told many times from a very knowing, true crime perspective, which is very popular right now, you know, telling a police procedural about the Yorkshire Ripper, or telling it from a dramatised adult's perspective. And we haven't heard the story from children. And I know, because I was one of them, that that time was the end of innocence for a lot of young children, particularly women, because we all knew about him, even though we were kids.
Well, exactly. It's not like you didn't know what was going on in your community. No. And it's something to be scared of and like to hear about. And, you know, I do not know all the details of this case, but like in a small community as well, it like seems, you know, what if you'd like know someone, or what if it seems like more real, and it's like it's not some big crazy thing that will never happen to you, like it's a lot closer to home.
If listeners remember my roundup of last year's stuff, The Longest Shadow on ITV was one of my like top watches of the year. It was so emotional.
Oh yes,
so,
I remember this too.
Yeah, okay, so good. I'm quite and I think that does a good job of portraying the fear that grown women felt. But yeah, could you take us through, obviously, from your perspective as a child, what you remember and your link, I guess, to everything?
Sure. I mean, I remember the term the Yorkshire Ripper from being very young, from maybe 6 or 7 years old. And in fact, one of the opening scenes in the novel, there's only two scenes that are stolen from real life. And it's one of the first ones, which is where Miv and her family are watching the 9 o'clock news and a murder is announced. And the newsreader uses the word prostitute. And Miv, who in this instance was me, actually said, "What's a prostitute?" I was such a curious child. I needed to know the definition of everything. And so I was immediately, "What's a prostitute? I need to know." And my dad, God love him, my dad said, "It's someone who helps the police," which is a definition I carried with me for some years.
Yeah.
And I was very young then. I was about 7 or 8 years old. And then the other scene that's borrowed from real life is the end, which, I mean, this isn't a spoiler to say that Miv does not find the Yorkshire Ripper. He was actually arrested in 1980. And the scene at the end of the book where he is captured is kind of a replay of what happened in real life, which is it was announced on the news that this man had been caught and confessed. And my dad was in shock. He just said, "Oh my goodness, but I know him. I know him." And it turned out that he had worked with Peter Sutcliffe for some years and was in absolute shock that this quiet, shy, wouldn't say boo to a goose man could be capable of such horrific crimes. And of course, I mean, I was only 10, but I've never forgotten that.
No, of course not.
It's one of the things that inspired the novel.
What I'm curious about is, like, when did you decide that this is how, I guess, the story would be told? Or, you know, was there something that kind of brought all the things together for you to actually start writing?
Sort of. In that, so I'd already decided I was going to write a novel. I'm a bookworm. It's something I've wanted to do since I was 7 years old. And at the time that I decided this, psychological thrillers were what everyone was reading, and I thought, I'll write one of those. That's what I'll do. And I started writing a psychological thriller, and it was terrible. I mean, it's abandoned now. It's in a drawer somewhere, never to see the light of day. And I realised that although it worked in terms of I had a plot and characters and all of that, but it had no heart. I could see that it was missing kind of any life to it. Mm-hmm. And I put it to one side and I thought, right, what am I going to write instead? And there were a couple of things. First is the BBC did a BAFTA-winning documentary called The Yorkshire Ripper Files, which was amazing. And it was about what it was like for women at the time, but it was very much about Yorkshire. And I grew up there and I watched this documentary, and it was like I was back in the 1970s. I found it incredible, so immersive. That was one thing that made me think, should I write about that time? And then, if you're a true crime fan, you might know about My Favourite Murder, which is a
It was very the first one I ever listened to, podcast. Yeah. Yeah.
And My Favourite Murder, they have a segment called Hometown Murders, which is, they have a theory that every person who loves true crime, that it comes from something that happened in their childhood that they now try to make sense of as an adult by being immersed in true crime.
I and made a podcast it's usually about my hometown.
About our hometown.
Yeah, our hometown murder. I did a podcast about that.
But too. It didn't happen while I lived there. Maybe that's why I'm not as interested.
Yeah, no, I was five when I
moved. Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, that's so funny. Well, because the the Peter Sutcliffe's crimes are my hometown murder. And
yeah,
so I thought about, maybe I should write into My Favourite Murder with my hometown. And then sort of the two came together in that I was kind of, okay, why don't I write a novel about my hometown murder? And it sort of came really from there. Although, to be honest, I had one of those rather mystical experiences where I was out walking the dog and the whole plot idea came to me, including the title, The List of Suspicious Things. And it never changed from that moment on. I just had to write it.
That's amazing. Wow. I also read in an interview that around the time you started writing, around like 2020 and 2021, when you were writing it, and I was living here then as well, obviously there was the case of Sarah Everard, which is an absolutely horrendous case, but it did bring up a lot of, I guess, again, as you mentioned, like the fear from women, this idea that we couldn't walk home safely, we couldn't just be out visiting our friends and stuff. And it echoed a lot of, I guess, the sentiments from those very first, like, Reclaim the Night marches and stuff, which came as a result of the crimes of Peter Sutcliffe. So I guess, did that feed in as well, that anger, I guess, because that does feed through, doesn't it? That idea that women aren't safe and women are, being told to just stay at home and all that sort of stuff.
Yes. I mean, that happened when I was probably in about my second draft of the book. And I am a very active Twitter user, or was, and people were sharing their experiences of fear of the things that had happened to them at the hands of violent men. And it's almost like I turned the dial up on that in the book, because I realised that this was tapping into something that continues now. If I'd written it and that hadn't happened, I think I may have imagined, in my very positive thinking way, that, we've moved on from that. Things are different.
This
now.
Kind of thing doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's so.
And then suddenly, this awful situation happens where it becomes very, very apparent that nothing has changed. And so I really turn the dial up on that experience in the book.
While you were writing and researching and things, and in that space, like while you're really in writing or editing, did you consume a lot of true crime content, or did you have to try and like stay away from it a little bit and like keep that part of your brain for the novel?
I probably, throughout that time, I'd started off very much in that space and then moved away from it, to the extent now that I'm much less of a consumer of true crime, because
than you used
you
to
both
be.
Know because you've read the book, it isn't a true crime book. And actually, Peter Sutcliffe is not in the book, apart from in the context of those kind of bookends. This is a book that's about community, it's about the impact of a crime on normal people going about their everyday lives. And I actually started off thinking it was going to be much more of a crime novel than it ended up being, which is very interesting. But as I moved into more of a kind of small town space, I think I've moved away from quite so much true crime in my life. To be honest, who needs true crime content? We've got the world right now, which is, you know, not full of great news. Think, so I'm no, only listening to happy things at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a...
Go through phases.
Like, you know, it's been a big trend and that, you know, there are millions of podcasts and books and crime content and, you know, all sorts of things that it is a big trend in entertainment. But I think, you know, even through COVID, there were so many like Netflix documentaries and all sorts of things, weren't there, that everyone was watching. But more kind of post that, as you know, as you said, the world is just enough on its own. There's, I think heaps of people are moving away from it. Like, there seems to be, I don't know if they're making less, but people seem to be talking about a lot of it less. You know, people are really just enjoying
it in a different way. I think, like, consuming it in a way that is like
content has evolved.
Yeah, so like looking at narratives in a different way. In some cases, like giving people back their stories. There's obviously more conversations, especially after the Ryan Murphy like Dharma documentary and stuff about like who can tell these stories.
Who gets to tell
like,
these
I think
stories.
The conversation is all perhaps a bit more nuanced, which is happens when something gets to be such a like trend in entertainment.
Even the kind of content that's like sort of in the space but makes fun of, you know, like Only Murders in the Building, or like there's a great other great series that I've watched called Based on a True Story, where this couple starts a true crime podcast because there's like a killer in their local area, but then they realize that they know the killer, and so then they try and blackmail him, and so it's like the podcast is like from the serial killer and they protect his identity, so then they're in it, and
he's like
accomplices now and we can't go to the police, like it's crazy
on
that's like a crime comedy. It's very fun.
On a like a more serious note, I recently read The Peep Show by Kate Summerscale.
Yes,
and
me too.
Yeah, highly recommend. It was brilliant, and I am very lucky to have a proof of Hallie Rubenhold's next novel. And literally on the back, it has a quote saying, "The killer should not." Hang on, I want to look this up because it's a really great quote. So, yeah, there's a quote on the back of the proof that says, "No murderer should ever be the keeper of their victim's story." And
yes.
I just think Hallie Rubenhold, so Hallie Rubenhold wrote The Five, again, giving those women back their identities, I guess. And the tide has shifted, I guess, a bit on the conversation that we have around these things. But let's kind of move away from that. You obviously mentioned that it's much more about community, and I totally agree. This book is not like a crime book per se. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the other people we meet in the book? Because I ended up loving all of them so, so much.
Do you have a favourite? You can say, by the way.
I think maybe Omar. Like, I think... Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I think so. And also, oh my gosh, sorry, it's been a little while since I've read it now, but the old man whose daughter, who they help at the library.
Arthur, yes. Right, so I only asked you, I didn't ask you to test your knowledge of the names because the names go out of my brain. I asked you to see if you say what everyone else says, which is Omar. I know you're not supposed to, as the writer, have a favourite character. It's a bit like having a favourite child, but I do, and it's Omar. And I find it very interesting that the person that I love the most in the book is the person everyone else loves the most, because clearly he was written with real love.
Yeah, there's probably something to that.
I genuinely think so. And often, it's usually between Omar and Auntie Jean, and Omar... is the local shopkeeper who has a son, Ishtiak, and he has moved over from Pakistan in the 1960s and lost his wife, Rizwana. And he and Ishtiak have kind of set up home in this new place. And he plays a key role in the book. And I adore him, because he represents for me all the hope in the book about how you can face difficulty and challenge. He's a real person, you know, he gets angry, he has his struggles, but he's fabulous. And Auntie Jean is based on my real Auntie Jean. I mean, I make no bones about that.
She's a legend.
Auntie Jean, she is a legend. And she, my Auntie Jean was a really formative character in my childhood, because I come from a very sort of working class mining family. And she married a scrap metal millionaire. They bought this big mansion in the Lake District. And I used to go there I used to spend my summer holidays there. And she just, I don't know, she was full of wisdom and common sense. But she also showed me more about what life could be. And I adore her. So she is based on my Auntie Jean.
Oh, I love that.
And it's a real ensemble cast, actually, although we've got Miv, but Auntie Jean plays a big role. Omel, the shopkeeper, plays a big role. Miv's dad and mum, you know, it is a community book. And Helen, the librarian, who I also love.
Well,
yeah,
of course, we love the librarian. I'm curious, though, with some of these people, like, you know, Auntie Jean is your real Auntie Jean, and like this is old, a lot is drawn from your childhood. Like, what did your family think of the book?
Oh my god, they love it.
Oh good.
I am genuinely really shocked about that. I thought I might get some comments around it. Unfortunately, I mean, it's really sad. My Auntie Jean now, she's in her 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and she has dementia. So although she knew I was writing the book, she hasn't read it and, you know, wouldn't be able to engage with it, I don't think. But what I love is that she is now forever enshrined in the novel. Like, that's part of my legacy for her, is that she is recorded somewhere. But no, the rest of them have really loved it, very much so, yeah, which I'm really pleased about. I mean, the characters are very clearly not them, apart from Auntie Jean. So I think that makes it easier. I even stole Miv's name from my Auntie Miv. So my auntie is Auntie Mavis, but everyone calls her Miv. So I asked her for permission to use her name, because I thought it was quite stood out. I thought, oh, that'd be a good name for a character.
Yeah, it's a good name. Yeah, definitely.
And obviously, Miv's friendship with Sharon is also a huge part of this. Obviously, friendships when you're a teenager, huge formative part of your life. So, yeah, I guess, did you enjoy writing that and exploring these young girls getting up to quite a bit of mischief in parts, but also also helping a lot of people?
So I really wanted to write about female friendship, especially that very intense teenage adoration that you have for each other. It's so important. And it was, for me growing up, it was hugely important. And my best friend when I was growing up, I mean, it was the classic best friend thing. We were only best friends because we moved to a new place and we were both the new girls from different places on the same day. So we were thrown together. We have nothing in common. We still don't have anything in common. And we have been friends for 40 years. And we still are friends. You know, I was chatting to her yesterday and I just remember the intensity of our friendship and how important it was. So much so that now she is to me like family, because we absolutely went through our most formative years together. And it's not a relationship that's written about that often. It's usually love relationships or romantic relationships that are written about. So I did want it to be a kind of tribute to friendship.
I know, writing about female friendship is so important. We definitely try and seek these books out. Now, we almost even got onto this before we hit record, and I need to bring us back there. Can you please tell us about your journey to publication? Because I'm sure it's fascinating. So take us on the journey. You've written the book. Now what?
I mean, so I just need to put out a warning to anyone listening. Not a warning. It's actually a great, everything that happened to me is great. It's like a Cinderella story or a fairy story. And it proves that it happens to people that aren't famous, because I'm not famous. And yet I've had this amazing, incredible journey. But I also...
This is why we love asking people, because everyone's story is completely different.
Exactly. They're all so different. And, you know, this doesn't happen that often, but it does happen. So that's my kind of content warning, I guess. So I was incredibly lucky. I did a Curtis Brown creative course during lockdown, which was all about writing your novel. But at the end of that course, what happens is they send your work out to a selection of agents with whom they have relationships, who might then ask to see your work. So I always say I didn't find my agent, she found me, because she read an extract of the list of suspicious things and emailed me to say, have you finished it? Can I see the rest? And it just so happened that that agent was the number one person I wanted to represent me.
Oh my god, amazing.
You know, wow. I mean, that was, I remember thinking, oh my goodness. And I sent it to her. It was on the 5th of January 2021, I think, or 22. The years mean nothing anymore. And she read it overnight and offered me representation the next day. So I didn't have the kind of tortuous, difficult journeys.
Rejection
finding an agent.
Letters and all sorts.
I mean, I did have some rejections because I'd started sending it out a little bit early. But to be honest, I was kind of, you know, Nell said, I'd like to represent you. And I just said, yes, without
Thank
question.
You.
And then it was quite an early stage with the book, really, in that it wasn't really long enough. It was only 65,000 words at that point. And she said, clearly it needs to be bigger, it needs to be longer. So I spent about a year with her feedback, rewriting the book and getting it, you know, 100% ready to go on submission to publishers. She decided to send it out in the May of 2022. I get confused about my years. Basically, the morning she sent it out to publishers, she sent me an email, said, oh, I've sent it a couple of days early to give editors the chance to read your book over the weekend. Because, you know, they send the whole book out to editors they choose, and they need time to read it. And she said, I thought I'll send it on the Thursday rather than a Monday. And I received this email, thought, great idea. Unfortunately, my mum had gone into hospital that day. She's fine now. But I was very distracted. So I didn't read the email in full. I didn't read who she'd sent it to. I thought, you know what, I'll look at that the weekend and I'll take it in properly and it'll all be fine. I had had my expectations managed to virtually zero, thinking I would be on submission for weeks, if not months, if not years. So no rush, right? So I'm in the car driving back from the hospital that afternoon. Sun shining, music's on, I know mum's going to be okay, blah, blah, blah. And the phone goes and it's Nell. And she basically said, are you driving? Could you please pull over? So 8 hours after the book had been sent out, I had my first offer.
Oh my goodness.
That's incredible.
And the next 24 hours, I was talking to editors from Penguin from my car in the car park of Stoke Mandeville Hospital, working out who I was going to go with, who I was going to choose. And we'd signed the contract by the following morning. It was just, it was insane. It was
that's
absolutely incredible.
That is, that's crazy. Yeah. And yes, that is very fast.
Yeah, I mean, it was really exciting and also very surreal because I was not in a let's talk about my submission headspace. And Nell kept saying, I'm so sorry, I didn't realise this was going to happen. She had the day booked off that day and had to abandon all plans while we basically worked through who I was going to go with. It was amazing. And I made my decision based on my incredible editor, Venetia, who is a titan in the industry. But I made my decision very instinctively because there is a piece in the early on in the book where Miv inhales her father's smell and he smells a Swarfiga. And you guys probably don't even know what Swarfiga is.
But not
it's
a clue.
Basically like this disgusting jelly, like antiseptic jelly that cleans oil off your hands. It's a very 1970s thing. And it's got a very particular smell. It's a very weird smell. Venetia, before I met her, sent me a text saying, I have to publish your book. My dad smelled of Swarfiga. And I always say to her, you had me at Swarfiga. Because I knew, she knew what I was talking about.
She got it.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She really got it. And I've never regretted that decision for a second. We've had a wild time. It's been great.
That's absolutely wonderful. And I think sometimes instinct is best to go on that sort of thing. Like,
Oh, for sure.
It's your creative work and she obviously gets it. Absolutely.
She really does, yes.
So you mentioned before we started recording and we said, wait, say that that you also started working in Waterstones.
Oh, yes, I forgot that bit. yes. So before I'd got an agent or a publisher, I had always decided I was going to take this really seriously. I'm definitely an all or nothing person. If I'm going to do it, I'm all in. And I decided that with the novel, I was going to be all in and I was going to really plan to have it traditionally published and in bookshops. I didn't realise then that how hard it is. And in lots of ways, I'm really glad I didn't know. So I wanted to understand how a book gets from a publisher into a reader's hands. What happens in a bookshop? How does it work? So I basically applied to go and work at Waterstones over Christmas in 2021. And I learned loads about how books get from publishers to customers. I learned very much about the power of a bookseller's love of a book. Never underestimate it, because that's what makes bestsellers. And I also learned something I didn't expect to happen, which is I love being a bookseller. So although I'd planned to do it for one Christmas to learn, I planned to do it for one Christmas just to learn how it worked. And I'm now on my, I'm about to go back for my fourth Christmas this year.
I mean, also impressive that, you know, you wanted to go back after Christmas proves that you really enjoyed it.
Yeah, because it's really hard.
After the most chaotic time of the year, it's so much. It's so much stock. And I've been doing a lot of the unglamorous work the last few weeks of sorting all the stock.
Yeah, I don't have to do any of that. I mean, I literally am front of house recommending books to people because I am a voracious reader, and so they just put me at the front of store and send all the men who don't know what to buy people, and I take them around the shop and fill their baskets up with great books.
It's so good.
What I love to do, and
I think there
really,
were a couple
really
of days there were a couple of days recently that I did not have fun at work for the first time in ages. And I think it was mainly because I was organizing stock and not chatting to customers. And so I came home and I was like, oh, I've not had any like fun conversations. But all it takes is like one person coming back in. We have lots of regulars and your store's quite small. So you probably have lots of regulars too, who come in and like they'll say they know to ask for recommendations, or they, you know, I was talking to a customer the other day and she turned to, pointed to where my boss was and goes, oh, he always gives good recommendations. So it's, yes, it becomes such a nice thing. Yeah. And
I always get messages from Michelle that's like, oh, there was a customer today and I, you know, recommended insert previous guest here, or like book we love here, yeah, or like, or she'll be like, oh, and there was like a teenager that came in and I recommended Alice Oseman, like, yeah, but not just Heartstopper, like all the others. Like,
I mean, honestly, I also have messaged previous guests to be like, just wanted to let you know that, you know, I had a really nice conversation with someone today and I sold a book to them. And, you know, I don't know whether that's nice as an author to hear, but it's just, even if it's just like one book, it's so nice to be able to be like,
is that nice as an author? Like, is it annoying? We love it.
Oh, no, to hear that the booksellers are selling your books.
I
am here for that.
I will let you know when I hand sell things. But
especially
yeah,
the UK authors know how valuable a Waterstones bookseller is. Since you started working there, I include it in like all of our pitching. And I'll be like, and Michelle works at Waterstones.
Yeah.
And like, all the PRs will be like, yep.
Yep.
One of my favourite things is working with teenagers who come into the store. Particularly my favourite question from a young person, which happens quite a lot, and I think BookTok has a, you know, is responsible for a lot of this actually. We have a lot of people who've read all the things they've seen on TikTok, and they come to me for what should I read next. And I get then the absolute privilege of recommending wider reading for them, things that they might like that are outside of the Sarah J. Maas and the Iron Flame, all of which are, I'm sure, fantastic. And there's a whole other world of books. Yeah, I love, that's my favourite thing, just walking around the shop and going, you might like this and you might like that. Oh, it's just a privilege.
I find it so funny when people are like, oh, I'm so sorry to take up your time. And I'm like, literally, this is my favourite part of the job. Don't apologise.
This is like the best thing.
This is what I live for. Also, I'm literally getting paid to do this for you, especially if you buy something. So don't apologise.
So funny, it's the best.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely wonderful. We have so many fun conversations and so many lovely things. Although I do get a bit nervous sometimes when I recommend something I really love, and if they make a joke like, "Oh, I'll come back and tell you if I don't," I'm like, "Please don't tell me if you don't like it. I don't want to have a conversation.
If I don't like it, I don't want to know.
I don't want to know." So yeah, it's a very fun job. We're very lucky to get to do this job.
Yeah, I really love it. Yeah.
It's excellent.
As a writer, do you find it inspiring to be around lots of books and talking to people about books, or is it a bit distracting sometimes?
Or intimidating?
It's all of those things, funnily enough. It's not distracting, though. I find it very inspiring. I mean, I am really inspired by others' writing. I know lots of writers can't read can't read fiction if they're writing fiction. I am not that person. I can't sleep unless I've read. So I'm always reading, and I've always got at least one book on the go, normally two, because I do audio and physical reading. And one of the things I think I find most inspiring about working in a bookshop is the connection that books bring. The conversations that you have are just filled with connection and joy, and you see the power of a book. Particularly on young people, actually, but also on all customers. I just am a bookworm. In fact, funnily enough, you can't see it, but I've got a bookworm. It's a bookworm t-shirt.
Oh, is it one of those Joni ones?
Joni bookworm sweatshirt. We're not sponsored.
No.
But, you know,
I wish we were.
And you fancy sponsoring, just let me know.
Send me all the book-related clothes. I will wear them. I'm actually also wearing a jumper that says Just One More Chapter. And that was designed by someone local, and it's amazing. But yeah, all the bookish clothes. Love it.
Well, I'm not wearing a book jumper because I'm
no, I was thinking you're more
hot
in florals.
Yeah. I'm in summer florals.
Yeah. Anyway, yes. That I feel like that's a really nice note to end on. Except yeah. to just we ask love books. You, are you obviously you're gearing up for the publication of the paperback, which, you know, in the UK yes. involves a lot of extra promotion, extra touring and stuff like that. Are you working on anything else at the moment as well? Are you also yes. trying to write? Yes, lovely. Lovely.
Yes. Yes. So I'm working on my second novel as we speak. I've just done a very intense writing week and I'm really excited to kind of announce what the second book will be.
Ooh, well, we will be good.
But
we'll
I can't do excitedly. That yet.
Yeah, we will be excitedly. No,
we won't press
that.
You for questions, but we're exciting. You know, we're waiting yeah. in anticipation. Yeah.
It's on its way for definite. Definitely. Yes.
Oh, amazing. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find and follow you online?
So I'm on Twitter as JennyG_author. I am on Instagram as Jenny.Godfrey. And I'm now newly on Blue Sky. I couldn't tell you what I am on Blue Sky, Jenny Godfrey. I think if you just search Blue Sky, Jenny Godfrey, I do come up.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I also have, if anyone's interested, a Substack.
Where
I actually do a Substack about creativity and writing. And that's called The Crow's Nest. So if you just put The Crow's Nest into Substack, I will come up.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. Such a great conversation to start a Monday.
Thank you for listening to Better Words. For even more recommendations, you can subscribe to our monthly newsletter on Substack at betterwords.substack.com.
We'd also love to continue the conversation on Instagram, where you can find us at BetterWordsPod.
You can also follow me, Caitlin, at Just a Bookish Babe.
And for more bookish discussions, find me, Michelle, on Substack at theunfinishedbookshelf.substack.com.
Just like with books, podcasts like ours rely on word of mouth recommendations.
So if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a book-loving friend and leave a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it.